And I'm trying to ratchet up the stakes here. Okay, let's look at the first analogy. And in ways that are typically perplexing, Kant offers two incompatible, or apparently incompatible, statements of what is to be the principle. So in the B edition, he states, in all change of appearances, substance is permanent. Its quantum nature is neither increased nor diminished. And that sounds like the principle of the preservation of matter. The principle states all appearances contain the permanent substance as the object itself, and the transitory as its mere determination, that is, as a way in which the object exists, which sounds more like something we might think about. So one of the huge themes here, which I'm going to underline, what you stated at the beginning, and it really only reaches clarity, I think, in the third analogy. And since we probably won't get there today, I'll mention it now. I'll leave it for the second analogy too. Is one of the huge distinctions between Kant and Hume is a shift in ontology that Hume operates with a pure event ontology. That is, for Hume, one event causes another event. And since events must be, by definition, distinct from one another, then of course he has all sorts of trouble with necessary connection between them. Lots of philosophers, not just you, believe in event ontologies. To say what I mean by event ontology, they think that events are the ultimate things that exist, and that things like objects are, think about any form of phenomenalism, constructions out of events. So the young Bertrand Russell, even the old Bertrand Russell, believed in an event ontology, which he was very explicit about. Events are the ultimate real. And when asked about the White Cliffs of Dover by a smart aleck in the audience, Russell's reply was, they are an event, just a very boring event. you want to see how Russell and Whitehead connected over this, of course, the idea of process and reality is the most elaborate form of a true event ontology. Objects are, I think Whitehead calls concrescences. And it's really bizarre stuff. I went we spend 6 months reading Process of Reality. And of course, this is a terrible thing about philosophy. You spend 6 months reading a book, and there is that moment you spend 6 months, it must be true, right? And then, you know, 6 months later you think, how on earth did I spend 6 months believing this crap?
Okay.
Which you may think about Kant sometime in the summer. Kant does not believe in an event ontology. He thinks that as this statement of the first analogy already begins to indicate that events are changes of states of objects. So that the notion of event becomes that of alteration and not a distinct existence. So Kant is changing, as part of his answer to Hume, the very fabric of the universe. But it turns out it's complicated, and a lot of those complications emerge even before we get the ontology laid out already in the first analogy. Well, like all of the analogies, and for reasons I don't really have an explanation of, there are too many arguments going on, and it's not clear that they're all compatible. Some of them look good, some of them look terrible. I'll suggest that there are two patterns of argument in the second and third analogies. In the first analogy, there seem to be three arguments. Each having, I guess, certainly worthy of note. And it's one of the things, it's worth doing all of this a little bit slowly. See Kant working something over, trying to get it right, clarifying an idea for himself. And by the way, his notebooks are just full of these attempts. He was always trying to refine these arguments and clarify them. And I think there's a sense in which, especially in the analogies, I find that in the second analogy is the worst. Let me just read. I mean, it's almost unreadable, I find. These puzzles of trying to get something right. Okay, so first analogy, and the first version of it is simply the first paragraph. So let's see what that's like when it's at home. All appearances are in time, and in it alone. As substratum, as permanent form of inner intuition, can either coexistence or succession be represented. So that just restates the schematism, right? Really restates the transcendental aesthetic. All appearances appear in time, whether as coexistence or succession. And the notion of substratum here is just the idea of time as a form of intuition in which things appear. And the substratum language is going to get squirrely on us very quickly. Step two, so almost each sentence is a step more or less. Step two, thus the time in which all change of appearances has to be thought remains and does not change. That is now trying to elaborate the meaning of time as form of intuition. Time as form of intuition remains, it doesn't change. Rather, it's things in time that change. For it is that which, and as determinations of which, succession or coexistence can alone be represented. So these are all statements about the meaning of time as the form of intuition, as the medium in which all this happens. Now, statement of what I call the omnipresent premise. Time cannot by itself be perceived. Third premise. Consequently, first inference, I'm just guessing that because it says consequently. Gotta take those little words seriously, right? Consequently, there must be found in the objects of perception, that is, in the appearances, the substratum which represents time in general, and all change or coexistence must, in being apprehended, be perceived in this substratum and through relation of the appearances to it. So now the thought is going to be, if everything occurs in time, and that's kind of unchanging, and then we just got all these appearances, and time itself cannot be represented, then we need some standing for that permanence of time, which is the container. That is, something in the appearances must, as it were, represent the permanence of time, its unchangingness to us. Because time itself can't be perceived. So how are we going to get the unchangingness of time? Well, we're going to get it by, somehow, by the appearances. But what could this now counterpart to the permanence of time be? But the substratum of all that is real, that is, of all that belongs to the existence of things, that is, it shows itself in time, is substance. And all that belongs to existence can be thought only as determination of substance. So now, with a rationalistic kind of premise, whatever it is that exists and that is what remains in existence, we're going to call substance, and we're going to just going to think of everything that happens as determinations of it. Consequently, so that, in other words, substance is the material analog of the permanence of time. It's not time itself. It's But its unchangingness, at least, is an analog of the permanence of time, and things that happen to it. Therefore, consequently, the permanent in relation to which alone all time relations of appearances can be determined is substance in the field of appearance, that is, the real in appearance, and as the substrate of all change remains ever the same, and it is thus unchangeable in existence, its quantity in nature can be neither increased nor diminished. I find that almost incoherent. I don't know about you. So the crucial premise is that something must represent time's permanence, and whatever represents time's permanence must itself be permanent. And this can only be the substratum of all that is real, namely substance. Well, the obvious flaw here, or at least my reading of it, is that it's simply nuts to predicate permanence of time itself. I guess I want to say that time neither changes nor is permanent. I just don't see how we're going to get access to those notions in talking about time itself. Now, he could mean the unity of time, why time is permanent and unchanging. But golly, it's not what he says. And something closer to that does come up as a separate argument. So this argument seems to have something to do with trying literally to find a material analog for time as form of intuition. And that just seems curious to me and doesn't really help much in thinking through the problem. Why doesn't it help much? Well, it doesn't help much because the next flaw in the argument is that it's not clear why permanence in something imperceivable must be represented by something that is itself perceivable and permanent. Think about, I mean, to use a vulgar analogy, we're quite happy for God, who's imperceivable and permanent, to be represented by all sorts of impermanent things, lambs, crosses, light. And then, why have as a corollary the last sentence, the conservation of matter? So something's misfired. I think I'm being maximally ungenerous here. But I'm being maximally ungenerous because there are phenomenological issues that are related to this. Namely, you can only perceive change against the background of non-change, right? What's classically called the backdrop thesis. But the backdrop thesis doesn't require permanence, right? I can perceive changes against things that are only relatively unchanging. So the phenomenological correlate is a kind of interesting idea, but it doesn't do what Kant wants to do. Let's try again. At A187, he begins to think about the problem of alteration. Better. Good problem. So he says, after a kind of build-up, turning right to the new paragraph, the correct understanding of the concept of alteration is also grounded upon recognition of this permanence. Coming to be and ceasing to be are not alterations of that which comes to be or ceases to be. Alteration is a way of existing which follows upon another way of existing of the same object. So, alteration is a, as I suggested before, a change of state in something, and namely a change of state in something that, as we'll discover a little bit later, must be one in which that object cannot bear those two states without being in contradiction with itself. So changing from, say, hot to cold. So it's something that changes from hot to cold, and something that endures, namely the thing that was hot and is now cold, and therefore the exclusivity of alteration, which I'm going to come back to, gets its force by the same thing not being capable of being hot and cold at the same time. Hence, we require, and that, what's wrong, man? I can see it like this.
No, okay, I was just thinking in relation to Aristotle.
And how's it contrast?
I'm just about the same idea.
It's working at trying to get exactly the work done by thinking that alteration gets its grip, the idea gets its grip, because the two predicates have to be incompatible. Right? And think about it, I mean, again, an event ontology can't do this. Right? You have the event of hotness, you have the event of coldness, and that's just it, that's what happens. I mean, that won't give you anything that happens. You just have random happenings. You don't have alteration, you just have pure change, unmappable. So the thought is that alteration has to be alteration to something. Alteration is, I just read that, all that alters persists and only its state changes. Since this change thus concerns only the determinations, which can cease to be or begin to be, we can say, using what may seem a somewhat paradoxical expression, that only the permanent substance is altered, and that the transitory suffers no alteration, but only a change inasmuch as a certain determination ceases to be and another begins to be. Okay. Now, that all seems right. But in his reflections, Kant came to realize that that principle was only a logical principle. I'm quoting from Wire, page 223. He says there, in every alteration the substance endures. For alteration is the succession of the determinations of one and the same thing. And now he says, this is a merely logical proposition according to the law of identity. But it does not say that in general substance does not come to be or cease to be, rather only that it remains during the alteration. So it doesn't give us any notion of permanence, it just makes a logical point about what we mean by substance. That is, that if we have the notion of substance, we have the notion of alteration. And I haven't, by the way, justified why alteration should be to substances yet. It only happens in the third analogy, really. All we've got here is a logical proposition. So that can't be an argument for the permanent either. It just states what our commitments are in this regard. However, the next paragraph, he really does have something like an argument. You have this marked up in your book, the red colors, and you see him smiling. He said, oh yeah, he finally got to it. Right? Alteration, and now he's beginning to think about, he's trying to think about knowledge of alteration. How do we come to have a knowledge of a state change? How do we come to have knowledge of an event? Again, remember now we're going to need three conditions, all three analogies, but here's going to be the first condition. We're going to need substance. Why? Alteration can therefore be perceived only in substances. And now he's going to give an argument for this. So now we get something like an epistemic argument, something that everything else has struck me as analogical or logical, but this is something like an epistemological claim. A coming to be or ceasing to be that is not simply a determination of the permanent, but is absolute, can never be a possible perception. Now we're beginning to get an interesting thought. We could never, he's telling me now, perceive something going clean out of existence, or something appearing literally out of nowhere. But rather, we must think of these events, in absence, as something changing. Say Pierre leaving the room, if you're a Sartrean. We can perceive an absence, but only against the background of existence and of a previous state. And we can conceive of something coming to be, but again, as an alteration. Now the room has here. So, for this permanence is what alone makes possible the representation of the transition from one state to another and from not being to being. These transitions can be empirically known only as changing determinations of that which is permanent. If we assume that something absolutely begins to be, we must have a point of time in which it was not. Now we're getting a further claim about the impossibility a raw disappearance or a raw ceasing to be. Roughly, in order for something to absolutely begin, we must have a point of time in which it was not. But what are we to attach this point if not to what already exists? That is, whatever we think of as coming into being, we see it as coming to be, if and only if we have the backdrop thesis now, that which already exists, of which it is an alteration. Say the number of people in the room. But to what? For a preceding empty time is not an object of perception. You can't have an empty time and then it gets filled up by something coming to be. What you have is a different time, but a different time means you have a determination of what exists, and now you're getting a new or different determination of what exists. So the very idea of ceasing to be or coming to be necessarily is a determination of what exists. And which persists in existence up to the moment of this coming to be. This latter must simply be a determination of what is permanent in that which precedes it. So, the claim now is, and I think this is what he was really thinking about, and the way I tried to state the other two, tried to hint that this is the argument where he was going, that knowledge of alteration in an enduring substance is a necessary condition for knowledge of any change at all. Only, and I want to make it epistemic and proper, only by treating a change as an alteration, notice the work that's going on here. Only by treating a change, let's say changes are indeterminate dummy terms, and I'm now saying only by treating change as an alteration, that's our beginning now of categorical determination, alteration of what? Of what exists, of something substance, of what endures, of what is permanent, can we have or make intelligible to ourselves that there has been an occurrence of change at all? Now, both Guire and Melnick misread this in verificationist terms. I am not claiming, nor do I think Kant is claiming, that we're looking for empirical verification here. I'm looking for empirical verification of change. I'm looking for its conditions of intelligibility. So I'm asking the question, and I think Kant is asking the question, not how can I empirically verify that change has happened. I mean, I guess sometimes that's a question, but where, I mean, you know, it happens all the time. Kant's question is, how do we, what, shape it, frame it to make it intelligible? And the argument is, it's only intelligible as an alteration of the unchanged. So that for every change, there must be something underlying it that is unchanging, and that eventually, of course, And now you can see why he thought it was conservation of matter, because, right, you know, the I'm guessing, is everyone having the same thought as me that the reason there was a fire at that Korean place is for insurance purposes? I mean, duh! You know, first they tried to get no unionization, then they closed down, and boom, up in smoke. Whoa! What an insurance scam. Anyway, okay. But, at any rate, Korean deli, smoke. Now the unchanging here is there's something remaining for Kant, namely the unchanging is, right, the actual constituents of the wood taking on a different form, namely ashes and smoke. And, if you're now going to be modern, releasing of energy. But that's fine, right, because then you're going to say there's something ultimate that again does not change. So every change has its own relative background of permanence and enduringness of what is altering. And ultimately, there must be the permanent itself, which again turns out to be, let's call it for the moment, prime matter, since you mentioned Aristotle. For Kant, the reasons I'll come to, it's forces of attraction and repulsion that underlie all change. Okay, it's time for the Critchley class, so let's stop there. And we will begin with questions about the first analogy and then trundle through the second and third analogy and the like next time. And I said what I would do. Well, we'll make it a double session. Double session in a sense now. I promised that for those who were having the angel of death pass over them, that I would do some recapitulation of what we did last week. And then we can also have questions about the material today. You know, extra 8 o'clock. Good.